I will give this presentation in English, I hope you don't mind, because my Czech is still not very good, for which I apologize. Thank you for showing up in such great numbers. It's wonderful to see such a large audience, and I hope I'll bring a few new points for you that you find interesting and stimulating in your work with computers. So what I'd like to talk about today is a little bit of history of computer-aided design, in particular in relationship to architectural design. Then I'd like to bring up a few points of a theoretical framework, a few theses about what the digital discourse is about, and in particular how it relates to the traditional discourse in architecture. And so I'd like to sum up with a few theses about architectural design and the computer. And of course, you're all invited to be to disagree with me and to ask questions at the end of my presentation. Well, the first thing I want to note, in the text which is on the poster, on the invitation, there is this phrase which says, "The computer is changing architecture." And this is not true, basically. The computer does nothing. What is changing is that architects are changing architecture. And in particular, architects nowadays who are working quite a lot with the computer, they are now at the front of thinking about what architectural design is, how architectural design process should be organized, and how these new digital techniques can be used to think in new ways about architecture. So it's not the computer that's changing architecture, it's the architects that's changing architecture. And that's really what I want to talk about. So if you would say there is this traditional view of architecture and there is this new view of architecture and somehow there is some kind of conflict between these two, then I would say yes, there is some kind of conflict, but no, it is not a very fundamental conflict in the sense of that someone is talking about architecture and maybe another group is not talking about architecture. Both groups are talking about architecture, but in a different way. They are using a different kind of discourse, a different kind of reasoning, thinking about architecture. And I think these are the points that I'd like to get some points clear in this presentation. A little bit of history. If I think the beginning of computer-aided design as we know it today basically was done in 1963 by Ivan Sutherland, who at MIT for his PhD project created a software called Sketchpad. And not only did he create a software called Sketchpad, as you can see, he built this whole machine in which he could use the computer basically in the same way as we are using the computer today. There is a screen, you interact with the screen. Is the microphone necessary? Do you need it?
No.
Okay. You interact with the screen. You get some information. You get some information about what the design does, what the design is about, and you can even see the traditional four isometric projections that he is even using at that time. So this you can basically see as the beginning of computer-aided design. And nothing has changed very much. Okay, the computer has become much smaller. It's no longer one room. It's something like this. You can carry it along. But the whole notion of interactive graphics and things did not really change that much. And even at the beginning, when this idea was introduced in 1963, there were many architects and many theorists who had ideas what the computer would do, and many of these ideas really have not changed, or we really have not been able to implement these ideas. I feel a little bit threatened now. It doesn't bite, does it? Okay. What is important to note is that there is a whole tradition of thinking about architecture, in particular the avant-garde architecture, the radical architecture, which basically is something that that we see today, but now with the use of computers. And one of the first groups that were very active in producing these ideas, I'm not saying they are using computers, but they are being very critical about architecture and what architecture is about. The Archigram group, of which you see a few images, now we're going to get some flutter. Of which we see a few images, the Living Part by David Green, the Instant City by Peter Cook, the Walking City by Archigram. These really were very, very radical ideas, and ideas that we might see again in a different shape today by people who are using computers. So nothing really much has changed in the sense of thinking very radically about architecture. These ideas are already quite old. To make a large jump in the work of Rem Koolhaas for the Grand Library in Paris, he was already investigating in a very iterative, theoretical manner how space, new space in architecture can be realized. And many of his ideas were very influential for architects who are using the computer today. In fact, many architects who are quite famous these days with using the computer come from the Office of Metropolitan Architecture. So they have studied with Rem Koolhaas or other famous architects like Zaha Hadid, Peter Eisenman, etc. Although these, for many years, were not known computers or known architects who were working with computers. So it's really about this way of thinking, critical thinking about architecture that's important. And in the 80s, we see this culmination of thinking about architecture and the meaning of architecture in the current of deconstructivism and postmodernism, of which we see. Of which we see an example here on this image of a deconstructivist project in Tokyo by Watanabe. Okay. This lecture is currently being deconstructed, and we are seeing new elements superimposed on top of each other. In particular, this microphone is playing a dominant role now. but also very, let's say, self-conscious architects who develop their own style, like Bart Prince from the USA, is really investigating new shapes of architecture and also new ways of making these projects. And here again, an example of Enrique Miralles, Eric Owen Moss, Morphosis. The main architect of Morphosis just got the Pritzker Award for Architecture. He's the latest laureate in this series. So, again, a good example of someone who's really thinking about the meaning of architecture. Someone more local from my country, René van Zuyck, an architect from Almere in the Netherlands, who is not using computers, but who is really thinking about structure and rhythm and the underlying meaning of architecture. And currently we are cooperating with him now at Eindhoven University in his projects to do some computer scripting and see if some of the forms that he makes can also be supported by computer scripting. So how does this culminate, this very short history of critical thinking in architecture? I think what we can see in the middle 80s, early 90s, when this whole wave of postmodernism and deconstructivism came, with famous architects like Eisenman, Hadid, Libeskind, Koop Himmelblau, Frank Gehry, Bernard Tschumi, what really happened was that form no longer was automatically related to meaning. Somehow, meaning had shattered away from form. If you would analyze form long enough, you would no longer be left with meaning anymore. You would just have the forms, and you would have the freedom to put in meaning in these forms in any way you would like. In particular, deconstructivism was very instrumental in thinking about how this relationship between meaning and form basically was arbitrary, and what you put into it really depends on what you as an architect want to do with that. And And I think this was a very important precondition to allow the computer to be introduced in the architect's office, because no longer it was necessary for the architect, the human architect, to create form. There was no longer the reason, the rationality of form no longer lies with the architect, it lies with anything. Anything that generates form would be a legitimate way of creating form. And one of these ways of creating form, obviously, is with the computer. So I think this tweaking away of the meaning from form, what happened in postmodernism and deconstructivism, was a very important condition for computer-generated form to enter the architectural discourse. Because if we would still be this critical about this form just means this particular meaning, then in particular the very early experiments with computers, I'm thinking about Marcus Novak and Stephen Perella, would very quickly be discarded as meaningless and just shapes or animations. But really because of this new discourse, they really had a chance to become recognized and to become part of the thinking of architects, what form and architecture is about. So this whole rationale about form and how form comes about, it really changed in this period. And new ways of thinking about form and meaning emerged. And one of these were obviously the use of the computer for generating form. Of course, meaning did not disappear. What did disappear was the one-to-one relationship between a column is means bearing of wall or structure elements, or roof means shelter. So these kinds of one-to-one meanings disappeared. But meaning, of course, itself did not disappear. And there really were three important issues that forced architecture to reinterpret what meaning is about. And the first one is the notion of the global village, or the rise of communication technology. Where the classical media were from one to many, like radio, television, one person reaches many people who are looking at the program, what we see now, it is really reversed. Now it's many to many. We have the internet, we have instant messaging, we have Microsoft Network, we have Yahoo, we have chat. So many people are communicating to many people. So there's a big reverse in how communication takes place, how information is being transferred between people. And another thing that we are seeing is ubiquitous computing, which basically means where are we putting our chips? And right now, already for 5 years, there are worldwide more microchips on the world than that there are people. So there are already something like 10 microchips for each person in this room. And where are these microchips? They are embedded in the furniture, they are embedded in buildings, they are embedded in cars and airplanes, they will be embedded in our clothing, we will get intelligent clothing, our mobile phone, of course, is embedded technology. So there is a lot of increased communication, increased data transport being integrated in our environment today. And somehow architecture needs to find an answer. But it's not really a question right now. There are not many people thinking about what this technology is doing for architecture. Another point what occurred was what I call technical dystopia, or basically what we found out was that the technical world, as we know it, is not really makeable. The late 90s, the 80s saw many environmental catastrophes caused by us not being able to handle the complexity of the environment. So there were many environmental catastrophes. So what we see is we are limited in our capacity to make the world as we really want it. Somehow we always run into some kind of invisible boundary of the things we can control. So the things we do always have unexpected effects, and then we try to solve these effects and we get another effect, we try to solve these effects, etc. So there is a whole question of complexity of the world that we have become much more aware of. So complexity really is one of the key words of architectural thinking today. Well, how do we deal with complexity in architecture? how do we create architecture that does not create much more bad effects than what we would want to do? Ah, thank you. The third issue that really came up in the last period is the question of sustainability, or how to keep the environment not from getting worse, but actually improving. So things like sustainable architecture really is one of the keywords today. We realize we have limited resources, and somehow our buildings will have to respect this, and our urban environments will have to respect this. So there's a lot of research going on in terms of zero-emission buildings, self-sustainable buildings, autarkian buildings, etc. All these new frames are being coined today, showing that we are thinking quite a lot about this issue, but we really don't yet understand it. And I would say that meaning in architecture really is connected to these three issues. So it's about communication, architecture and communication. It's about the limits of our technical capabilities, and it's about sustainability. I think in these three terms, architecture will be rethought, is already being rethought, but will be further developed in the next few years. Now, apart from the architectural field itself, computer-aided design, of course, also developed outside of the architectural field. And you might even argue that it developed mostly outside of the architectural field. In particular, in the area of computer graphics, where we see a lot of development, aerospace industry and car industry. So most of the technical advances in computer-aided design really occurred in these areas and not in architecture. Architecture is not a motor of innovation in computer-aided design. We are users, we are not developers. Nevertheless, there has been a lot of research going on. So say since the 1960s, 1970s, well-known research institutes like MIT, Carnegie Mellon, Key Center of Design Computing in Sydney, the University of Strathclyde, there are many, many more. And really CAD pioneers from the early days like Ivan Sutherland, Herbert Simon, John Lansdowne, John Fraser, Tom Maver, Arturo Montague, really pioneers from the early days of CAD, and people who really had a vision how CAD could be used in architectural and urban design. Many of these people, unfortunately, are not alive today. I think from this list, only John Fraser and Tom Maver are still active. And these people really have investigated the use of CAD in architectural design, and they have also done lots of research, developed lots of applications for architectural design that somehow we see now integrated in the software that we are using today. And even many of the softwares that these people developed are still not available as standard packages in our CAD software today, which really is a big shame. In this period of the 80s and 90s, also the worldwide organizations of computer-aided architectural design researchers formed. So you have EKD, which is the Association for Education and Research in Computer-Aided Architectural Design in Europe. So that covers the Europe area, say. ACADIA, which is for North America. CADRIA, which is for Asia. And SAGRADI, which is for South America. And 3 years ago, there was a new association started, ESCAD, which is for Arabia. And these organizations, since the 80s, really form a worldwide network of people who are researching CAD, who are doing education in CAD, and they are talking each year about what they discovered, what they are researching, how they teach CAD. So there's a whole network of these people in the academic world that are talking and thinking about computer-aided design in our field. And I think what we see happening in the middle 90s, the early 90s, we see these two streams. We see the architectural thinking with big thinking tanks like the Office of Metropolitan Architecture, Zaha Hadid office, Peter Eisenman office. And we see these research and education institutes where more of the academic research is being done at MIT, Carnegie Mellon, ETH Zurich, etc. And what emerged from the combination of these two, so not just from architecture and not just from academics, but people who graduated from these institutes and then worked at one of these big critical firms, but then using the computer in new innovative ways. And these really are the first wave of architects that are really known for their pioneering work on computer-aided design as it is applied in architecture. So these are the people like Steven Perella, Christian Muller, Marcus Novak, Greg Lin, Lars Spijbroek, and Cas Oosterhuis. And if you Google on the internet for one of these names and you search for images, then you will find all the well-known images that you see in all the websites and all the publications on e-architecture coming from these people. But I would say this was only made possible from coming from an academic world in which CAD was taught and researched, and then working in these critical think tanks that were thinking about architecture in a very fundamental and critical way. And these two streams came together and formed the founding ground for these architects. I think that's very important to point out. Now, this was also somewhere about the period in which I myself entered the field of architectural computing. I graduated in Eindhoven in 92. Then I did my PhD research from 93 to 97 and became a postdoc from 97 to 99 and then associate professor at Eindhoven. And now I also this month began as associate professor at the Faculty of Architecture here in Prague, of which I'm very pleased. Some of the keywords of my work in these past, say, 15 years with architectural computing, the most important, obviously, is architectural design. This is my main topic, what I'm interested in. But then, in particular, the design computation aspect of architectural design. So how can we represent and compute architecture, not just the architectural design itself? And another key word that I've been doing quite a lot of work in is virtual reality and how that influences the design process and thinking about architectural design and design methodology in particular. So studying how particular architects are using the computer, how it changes their design process, how they reason about what kind of role the computer has in the design process. And I'll just give you a few examples of some of the work that I did with my students and with my colleagues in the past few years. So in the first place, research on design methodology. The best way to learn from architects, apart from doing architecture yourself, is studying architects, which is what I did. So I read a lot of books about written by famous architects like Eisenman, Lin, Van Berkel from UN Studio. I talked with them. I went to their lectures. And from this work, I tried to understand how their design process functions, how they use the computer, and in particular, how their architectural theory is formed by thinking with the computer. And from this work, I tried to derive design methods, design strategies, if you like, and then worked with my students to see if they could work in the same way, trying to understand how this design process works. And rather than trying to create Eisenman clones or Van Berkel clones or Greg Lin clones, the objective really is, if you work once with the working method of someone else, it really is a very good occasion to understand what your own working method is, because you very clearly see the differences between the working method of someone else and your own working method. But it's very difficult to get an understanding of your own working method if you don't really have something with which you can contrast it. And these are just a few examples of works created by the students. And the animation that I showed in the beginning from the student on the bottom left was also created in this framework of thinking about design methodology, thinking about the computer in the design process. I've also had quite a number of Master of Science graduation students for their final project in architectural design. And I'd just like to show a few of them. In many cases, we use virtual reality in the final project, really for getting from the first start of the design process a good idea what the design can be, what the design can be about. And just to give you an idea how this can work, what we developed in our research is what we call a desk cave. You see it running right there on the screen. A desk cave basically means you have a chair or a table at which you work, and you have on all sides projection from a 3D model, also on the tabletop itself. And when you are sitting at the location where this person is sitting, you get a really the one-to-one scale feeling how big the model is. So it has a one-to-one scale visual impact of the design. And of course, the most obvious function for using virtual reality is simply to walk through the design and to get an idea how the design works. But especially if you use this kind of approach in the early phase of the design project and you don't really have a very detailed model, even then you can get a very good spatial idea of the design that you have been making. And I would argue you get a better spatial idea of the design you have been making than if you would be working with other representations. So if you would be sitting behind your computer and make an animation, or if you would make a scale model, or if you would make drawings, or just basically try to imagine it in your head. Of course, these other representations have their own value. Making a scale model, for example, helps you haptically understand what your building is about, and it teaches you the tectonics of a building, which virtual reality obviously does not. But especially for spatial reasoning, visual reasoning, VR really is a very well-suited technology which we are developing in Eindhoven. Another issue that we have looked quite a lot at with graduate students is the relationship between CAD and CAM, computer-aided manufacturing. And there is one project in which this really is worked out to a quite large extreme. This was a project for an underground music center in New York. And this student refused to make drawings, refused to make scale models, and he simply started in the computer and tried to make everything in the computer. And this is the ultimate rendering of the computer model as it's completely finished. And basically, the point of view in this work was that the rendering or the model is the building, rather than some kind of representation of the building. And as you can see, the scale level inside the model is really very, very high. You can zoom in until almost until infinity. And I'm not quite sure if the viewer from Microsoft is up to the task. Well, I think you get the idea of the level of detail. And this is all three-dimensional model. This is not a rendering of the... Yeah, it's of course a rendering, but it is the three-dimensional model itself. So in principle, if you would attach this to some kind of building information model like industrial foundation classes, you could, in principle, it's of course not possible, but you could build this design from the 3D model. And some part of that he actually tried to do, which you see here on this picture. He took the 3D model that he had and then put it to a 3D milling machine and told the milling machine how to create the scale model of his building. So in the end, obviously, he had a scale model. But again, he did not want to do it by hand. He just sent his three-dimensional model to the milling machine, and then that machine produced his model. And this image below shows a little bit the overlap between the 3D digital model overlaid on the realized physical model to show how large the resemblance is between the 3D model and the scale model. Another student who worked also with rapid prototyping techniques is this student for a bus stop who wanted to create some kind of passageway along the parking area for the car trucks for which he made a design. And in the beginning he did not, he wanted to make the scale model by hand, and he tried to make it in clay, and it really did not work. And then in the end he said, okay, I really need more precision in creating this object. And so he also turned to rapid prototyping techniques. Basically in 3 weeks he learned himself how to do that, and output this whole model for rapid prototyping techniques, so that he really got the thing that he wanted with the right level of detail and workmanship for his scale model. So just a few examples of students working on the final design. Yeah, as I said, virtual reality, in my view, is really a very crucial technology for understanding the spatial consequences of your design. The Descave is one of the research projects that we have been developing in our group. And what you see here is the latest variation or incarnation of our idea of this Descave technology. It's called the virtual scale model, which was built for the university board. The university has a very large scale model of the campus site, of which the board always shows their visitors what the campus is like and what ideas they have. But they really wanted to have a modern variation of this scale model, and they thought, okay, why don't we get something virtual? And they contacted, among other people, our group for doing the interactivity of this model and also the VR environment. And how this works, as you can see on the bottom, on the table is projected the plan of the campus, and on the opposite screen you see a view, three-dimensional view of the campus itself. And the view is controlled here. Here you see a small block which is being detected from the top by a camera. And if you rotate the block, it's as if you are rotating within the model of the campus. So if you rotate the block, the image that is projected on the vertical screen will also rotate with you. So basically what you do, if you want to see a particular building in the campus, you simply move the block to that location, you orient it in the right direction, and you see on the vertical screen the building that you are looking at. Of course, if this is just the current campus as such, it's nice but not very interesting. So we expanded the functionality by adding also the future plans of the campus itself. So the whole master plan of the development of the campus until the year 2020. And if you then look at one of these buildings, you can put a different square on top of a building, and then you get projected all the data of these buildings that you see. So this is more a little bit of applied research, again with the use of virtual reality in a project. In the past few years, I also did quite a lot of workshops, in particular here at the Faculty of Architecture. And in March this year, there was a very nice digital architect workshop, in which we had a very enthusiastic group of a lot of students. And these are just a few of the images of the works that were produced in this workshop. And I think what was really very nice was in this 5-day period where people brought their own computers to the workshop to create really this work atmosphere People worked very, very hard and created the most wonderful and sometimes even weird designs in this 5-day period. I have to say the workshop was organized by the people from eArchitect and MOLAB and supported by the Faculty of Architecture. And also the students who worked in this workshop were really very, very enthusiastic. So it was a great joy to work in this project. If you want to see more images from this workshop, you can view it on the website of eArchitect. There you can find these results. To round off, I want to make a few observations about how I feel discourse, architectural discourse, is developing at the moment. And I'd like to end with a few points maybe exaggerated a little bit, or maybe a lot, of how electronic discourse relates to the traditional discourse in architecture. I think if you look at the traditional way of architectural discourse, it's very much type-based. It's very much based on the formative principles of architecture. What are the good ways of doing architecture? What are the fundamental forms? What are the fundamental ways of organizing architecture? Whereas I would say, if you look at how digital architects, if I may use this dreadful term, how digital architects are thinking about the fundamental forms, they are more thinking in terms of prototypes. They are thinking in terms of constellations of parameters, constellations of characteristics that can develop itself in time, either through their own internal behavior or with their interaction with the environment. So it's no longer a fixed idea, it's no longer a type, but it's something that can develop itself in time. I would argue that traditional architecture is very much object-oriented. It's very much oriented towards the designed building, the realized building, rather than the process, or rather than the... not really the rationale, but the development of how this design came about. I'm not saying no one is thinking about it, but it's just not featuring a major role in traditional discourse. On the other hand, if you look at the electronic discourse, then you would find it's more data-oriented. It's more with this idea of complexity. We need data, we need information. We have to understand what's going on in the world, what's going on with the building, the environment, the activities that people are doing. So we are gathering data. We are trying to analyze this and trying to get some kind of bigger picture what's going on with the building design. In many cases, the historical argument has been performed or produced through text. By means of essays, by means of historical research, by means of manifestos. And you could argue that today what replaces the function of the manifesto, so to say, I have this idea and we should do it now like this, is no longer the manifesto itself, but it's the animation, it's the model, it's the simulation. So rather than arguing in a text-based way, you are simply showing it. You are making a model and you are trying to show how this model functions, and by that you are trying to derive the points that you want to make in your argument. Where architectural discourse would focus on the single design, so the single product that has been realized, I would say that in current day thinking about architectural design, we are more thinking about the variability of design. What are the core aspects of a design and how does it change? So no longer trying to get to this ultimate one answer to a design problem, but rather trying to understand all the variables and the ways in which a design can change. Um, in the traditional discourse, there is an incredible amount of knowledge. You need a lot of knowledge to be able to design. And that has always been true, and it's still true today. And the traditional body of knowledge in architecture really is very, very large. There's a lot of knowledge incorporated in the field of architecture. And throughout the years that you study here architecture, you are being transferred this whole body of knowledge. And later, when you are going in practice, you learn additional things, more the practice-based aspects. But you are still learning. Your whole life long, you are learning about architecture. The point is that much of this knowledge in architecture really is implicit. You learn it by doing. There are no textbooks, or at least not many textbooks, that are really spelling out all the rules of the game. And basically because it's very difficult, very tedious, very boring to do so. It's much more fun to design. And you learn designing, of course, by doing design, rather than reading a book with many, many rules. Nevertheless, if you are going to work with computers or trying to use the computer more in your design process, you have to be much more explicit of your knowledge. You really have to understand all the little rules of transformation, of derivation, of inference, in order to make the computer do something that you want to do. So on the left-hand side, you see one of the most explicit forms of architectural knowledge, the really excellent work by Jean-Nicolas-Louis Durand, about his work and the architectural knowledge of that time, how you would create buildings. But if you would want to use that in a computer, it's not enough. It's still not enough. You need to do much, much, much more. And on the right-hand side, you would say, okay, here is the new variation of the Durand sheet on the left. It's a shape grammar, and in a shape grammar, you have all the tiny little rules that will tell you how to get from almost nothing to a realized design. And this is an example of a shape grammar design which creates Alvaro Siza's housing design in Portugal. And you will be amazed at the number of rules that you need just to make these very, very simple derivations of house designs. You literally need hundreds of rules, and they all have to be fired in exactly the right order in order to create a reasonable house design. But still, my point is not that we should do that, but rather that there is still a lot of knowledge that we are using which still is implicit. And if you want to use the computer more in the design, you have to become much more explicit what kind of knowledge you are using in the design process. So to sum up these points, and of course I realize this is a very exaggerated opposition of terms. If you would say the traditional discourse, it's type-based, it's object-oriented, it works by means of the essay, the historical research, the manifesto, it's focused on single designs, and it has a lot of implicit knowledge. Whereas the digital discourse, it's prototype-based, it's data-oriented, it's about simulation and making models, it's a variable design, and it uses explicit knowledge. And to add just a few other ideas, much of the reasoning in traditional architectural discourse is philosophical by nature, and the modes of argumentation really derive a lot from philosophy or from artistic reasoning. Whereas I would say, if you are looking at the digital discourse, the rationale for arguing for things really comes from computation. If I can compute it, it is a sensible argument. If I can't compute it, it's void. It doesn't work. The traditional discourse really is associating itself with the classical arts. So sculpture, painting, and architecture. This is really the great family of arts in which architecture in the traditional discourse tries to locate itself. If you look at the digital discourse, they are much more locating themselves in the new arts, photography, movie, animation. And I think really a very important point if you look at how architecture manifests itself in the traditional discourse, then it is that, that form ultimately, or better to say, technology ultimately manifests itself in form. So the house layout, the spaces, but also the services, elevators, air conditioning, etc., all at some point are embedded in form, in the systems that are making up the building design. And I think there has been a shift. We still create form, of course, but I think technology these days really is manifested now in behavior. It's really this idea of ubiquitous computing, chips are being everywhere, all kinds of control mechanisms are surrounding us, and we don't really know how they work or how to control them. And it's really about behavior. It's no longer the shape itself. And as architects, we are going to be much more managers of behavior, of systems that are surrounding us, rather than only form. It's not just only form anymore. Well, I think that's that came to the last points. So, yeah, I think from the presentation, I hope to have shown you a little bit how the historical development was, and I try to have shown, maybe to some point of exaggeration, how I feel the electronic discourse today is forming itself. Thank you for your attention, and if there are questions, I will be happy to answer them. Yes?
I would ask you, you have been talking about advantages of digital architecture, so can you tell us something about disadvantages?
Yes. There are plenty of disadvantages. I'm not quite sure if I mentioned advantages. Maybe you read these points over here as advantages. They are certainly differences, maybe not particularly advantages. I think many disadvantages, if you are looking at only digital design and you are not sketching anymore and you are not making models anymore and you are not reading books anymore but just Googling on the internet, then you really run a risk that you get this tunnel vision of architecture is just what I can create on the computer right here. And it's really very, very limiting. You have to really expand your scope of architecture as much as possible. So you have to go to lectures, you have to make models, you have to sketch, etc. So I would say, well, if of course, what's very tempting if you are working with the computer is it's available. You can do it right now, right here. You don't have to go to a workshop and make something. You can sit nicely at home, make your models in the computer, and think, okay, I can do everything I want, I'm an architect. But of course, that's not true. Being an architect and becoming an architect involves much, much more things. It involves discussion with your colleagues, going to exhibitions, and all these things. And I think the main disadvantage of the computer is that it is so tempting to withdraw from the rest of the world, say. So that is what I would say the main disadvantage. Maybe you have a question? Yes?
Are there any main differences in the thinking about the usage of computer-aided designs and things like this between architecture, urbanism? Because every time you mentioned some historical data, you were orienting it much more towards the city, towards larger scales, and talking about CAD-CAM production, about your own projects, about, I don't know, mostly the projects you show were oriented to the architecture, to the project based on a house or a used project. Do you see that there is no difference, that it's just like a process that develops on a certain scale and that the process is the same? Or do you see any difference in the usage of computer-aided design or computer-designed architecture between the scales? Is there any difference?
There surely is a difference. I would say that urban design, and in particular the planning tradition of urban design, has a much larger history in using models and using decision theory for understanding the future developments of design. So they are much more prone to integrating the computer, especially in the reasoning process, in trying to understand the whole complexity of what's going on in the urban design, and then in some rational way or semi-rational way structuring the reasoning and decision processes. If you look at the urban designers, say the designers who are doing the artistic approach in urban design, so people like Leon Krier, for example, who are not at all involved with these planning aspects, you can very much relate them to how architects work in the architectural field. So there's really no difference in level of skill on that level. But because of this history, the planning history of urban design, this field is much more used to using computer-aided design in their field. No other questions? What shall we do?
Pokud nejsou teda dotazy, tak poděkuju Henriachtenovi za přednášku a pokud byste chtěli skonfrontovat třeba váš projekt někdy v budoucnu s jeho teda názory, tak můžete navštívit jeho ateliér, který tady vlastně od tohoto semestru má možnost vyučovat. Děkujeme.
Okay.